Ready, fight. Welcome to my dojo. This is Kung Fu Pizza Party, and I'm your host, Brandon Knight. And today, we are going back to the arcade for the first film review of this series as we get ready for the upcoming Mortal Kombat 2. Joining me here today, once again, is Joe Day from all of your favorite nerd shows. He's on it, all of them. Even the ones that you didn't realize, he's on all of them. Today we're talking about Mortal Kombat from 1995. Joe, welcome back to the dojo. How are you doing today, sir?
Doing good. I am stoked to talk about this gem from my childhood.
You know, I kind of want to get started right there, too, because I was technically alive when this movie came out. Technically. But I saw it on TV a few years later. You were, I'm assuming, you were like the age demo for this movie when it first came out. So take us back to 95. What was it like when this movie first dropped?
Oh, spot on. I was exactly the right age demo. This movie hit video stores and took over, because at this point the game, like we had talked about in a previous episode, had already captured the attention of young people. And so this movie coming out, like, you would hear about how this was a faithful adaptation and all of that, and not that necessarily kids really cared about that sort of thing, but like, you heard about how good it was, and then once it hit video stores, that it was hard to find a copy at first because they were just selling out consistently.
Yeah, we grew up to become little assholes that cared about canon and accuracy and all that kind of stuff later on. But in the 90s, when it came out, like, I think we, you know, for your age group, I can imagine it was just more so the excitement of the thing that you loved got a big budget production. And a good one at that. This movie holds up. I just watched it the other night to refresh my memory. It had been a while since I'd seen it. And this movie, from the very second you press play, is balls to the wall action. It is jumps right in with the now iconic Mortal Kombat theme. Like, and even like special effects wise, just to sound snooty for a moment, like, yeah, Reptile, the whole Reptile thing is a little rough now, but like all the rest of it, it's aged pretty well, I think.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Like, you could sit there and go like frame by frame by frame and talk about clipping and all of this sort of nonsense, but like, really, if you're doing that and you're trying to treat this movie like it's The Godfather, you've missed the point. this movie, like, even the soundtrack, right? So like, you made the joke at the very beginning, but that is it Techno Syndrome?
Theme
is like, it was like a drug for kids. Like that started, and like the reptilian brain in children all fired, like synapses. Like, you need to do a brain study on the effects of kids in the 90s when hearing that song, because like, it set you into that world and like let you know what you were in for and didn't let up. And when you're starting the conversation at this movie made the archetype, like the visual representation for a character for the rest of the canon, and the whole thing was choreographed by a legitimate martial artist and mm-hmm. legitimate stunt actor, like, and then you've got a movie that like should not have worked with the budget that it had, and you had people who genuinely cared enough to invest themselves. And was it Christopher Lambert who paid for part of to be at some of the shooting on his own dime, just so that way he would be a part of the entirety of the movie. That's how much people invested into this project, and it shows.
Fight.
And when it comes to that song, like, forget kids in the 90s at the time, I'm watching it as a 32-year-old, and I'm like, let's go break stuff. Let's go do something right now. Like, it does something to your head. And you brought up the fight choreography and stunt work done by the iconic Patty Johnson, who is probably more so recognized for being the fight choreographer on the Karate Kid trilogy. He's the referee during the final fight between Daniel and Johnny Lawrence. I think he's also has a few other notable. He did some of the Ninja Turtles, right? I think he did some of the Ninja Turtle films as well, correct?
Yeah, he was the choreographer for the first two.
Okay. The two good ones. They're all good in their own
way. They're all good in their own, yeah, in their own way. But yeah, but that sort of thing, like, if especially for folks that are in the world of martial arts, which I don't know if I've ever mentioned in one of the episodes that I've been in on the show, but I also come from the martial arts world, and so, like, as a kid, you're not necessarily paying attention to that. Like, not unless you are already in that world. But, like, as you get older and watching the choreography, it all, like, holds up from an actual martial arts standpoint.
Mm-hmm. It does hold up really well. Some of the fights, I would say, especially with Liu Kang, are very technical. And then you have, like, the Johnny Cage Scorpio match, which is very good, but I would say is the one that is the most like you were gonna play Mortal Kombat. The rest of the fights, like, the fights are good, but the Scorpio Johnny Cage is the one that I think feels the most like playing Mortal Kombat. You're throwing people around, you're using your environment, it's back and forth, versus like whoever it is that Liu Kang fights in the first round, that is like total squash match. Like, right off the bat, we are establishing he is legit.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And that's really how it should be. So, like, in some regards, what made Mortal Kombat the sensation that it was is that there is an element to it that is very grounded. Because the fights are brutal and technical, but you also are in a world filled with ninjas that can turn into reptiles, ninjas that are essentially undead revenants, magic powers, and four-armed monsters. And so there is a fantasy element to it. And so talking about Scorpion, that was this figure that, like, was the guy in the original version. So, like, you had Goro, you had Shang Tsung, but when it came to the playable characters, Scorpion was the fan favorite. And so it made sense that they would give him more of the fantastical elements of the movie.
And if you're one of those dweebs like me who really likes Sub-Zero, sorry, folks. Not only does he get killed, Scorpion gets killed too, but not only does Sub-Zero get offed, he does not get that much screen time. If there's one complaint I have about this movie, is that there's not enough Sub-Zero, which is probably one of the reasons why in the reboot from 2021, I was a little bit more like generous towards it. A lot of people panned that movie. I was happier because I got more Sub-Zero.
Yeah, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. So, like, I really like Sub-Zero as well, and he's got a full arc that, especially like the original Sub-Zero, has a full arc that is really cool in like the games and all of that jazz, that the new movie touches on more. But this one, that's really where, like, so Scorpion and Sub-Zero both, that's probably the point that it diverges the most from the in-game continuity. But everything else around it is so good that it really doesn't matter.
True. Yes. It's an enjoyable film, and it's the nice and tight 90 minutes in and out. It does not drag. There's always some kind of action going on somewhere in the film. I think they do a really good job too of, particularly for the 90s when this movie came out, I think they do a really good job of making a film that appeals to the hardcore fan base while also explaining the rules of the universe and everything and who the characters are in a way that's not insulting to the fan base, but also puts the cookies on a lower shelf enough that casual people who just want to go see the action movie that everyone is talking about can very easily like understand, like, oh, these are the good guys. There are monsters. There's a fantasy element. This is the rules of engagement. I think they do a really good job with that.
Yeah, I agree. And one of the smartest moves that it makes is that it doesn't try to add where there isn't meat on the bone to add. So by this point in time,
true,
the second movie is out, or the second game is out, which expands on the lore a little bit. But it's still very much within the realm of a martial arts tournament to save Earthrealm from invading forces. And it sticks pretty faithfully, while moving some puzzle pieces around, it sticks faithfully to the beats of that first game and doesn't try to throw other things in. And I think part of where this movie is such a byproduct of its time is, even though there is CGI and there is puppet work and there are special effects and all of that jazz, it still is coming out at a time where Hollywood is still making low budget action movies. They're still making movies that don't need to be treated as tentpole blockbusters, and there's still room to be able to make the most out of that. And it shows that it's made by people who are truly passionate about telling the story of Mortal Kombat.
I want to, at this point now, you brought up one of our stars here in this film. I want to talk a little bit about our cast. So let's start off first with who you brought up a moment ago. Christopher Lambert is in here because there can only be one Highlander and defender of Earthrealm. Apparently, this role originally was pitched to Sean Connery, who turned it down. And the entire time, as I'm watching the movie, I'm trying to do my best Sean Connery impersonation to hear what it would have sounded like.
Yeah.
In the end, though, the way that Mr. Highlander delivers his lines in this movie, the whole time I'm like, why do you sound like Mel Brooks playing yogurt in Spaceballs? There's just something about like the timing, because this movie is like, it's not a comedy, but there is humor elements in this movie, and just anytime he was talking, I was like, why do you sound like yogurt right now? What is going on? Do you like the alternate universe where Sean Connery does take this role? What do you think of that?
No. I'm not a huge Sean Connery fan. I think Christopher Lambert is a dedicated character actor who's unafraid to play camp without trying to be Shakespearean about every single thing. And there's a little bit of Shakespeare in Christopher Lambert's performance, but only insofar as he's playing it up for the camp factor of he is an immortal thunder god in a world of gods and monsters, but ultimately is playing it in a way that he's never stealing the scene from anyone else. And I think somebody like Sean Connery wouldn't be able to put his own ego aside that he wouldn't be trying to steal from other people.
Next, let's talk about our lead. We have Robin Sho as Liu Kang. Sho is going to be featured on Kung Fu Pizza Party a lot when you look at his filmography. He came from Hong Kong action, and he would go on to be in movies like Street Fighter, Legend of Kung Lee, playing Jen. He's Chris Farley's brother in Beverly Hills Ninja, which I will absolutely cover. That movie has to be covered here on the show. That is a top priority. And several other just like action films, but this served as his first introduction to American films. If he was like in American films like a couple years before, I totally could have seen this guy playing Bruce Lee in the 93 Dragon film that Jason Scott Lee does a wonderful job at. But I can see with the build and trim up the hair a little bit, he would have been a shoo-in to play Bruce Lee in the 90s.
100%. 100%. And Liu Kang is a vanilla protagonist. In
absolutely.
By every standard and measurement, it's really not until the PS2 era games that Liu Kang becomes anything more than that. And so he plays it in a way that allows the physicality to do the talking while still having some good dialogue.
Yes, I did. You know, you bring up the vanilla. He's a white meat baby face for sure in this movie. It was funny as I'm rewatching this because I was younger the last time I saw this movie. As I'm going along, I was like, oh, yeah, this was technically a movie made for youth, maybe not children, but this was definitely a movie made for youth. They toned down the violence. There's still a good amount of like action in the movie, but like the gore is definitely turned down for the movie. And also there's a whole subplot in here about facing your fears and overcoming your fears, and every time that came up I was like, oh yeah, this is a kids movie, I forgot.
Yeah, but it was a kids movie that took itself seriously enough to also be enjoyable to adults. And
absolutely,
there's a reason why, for most people, myself included, if you ask what is the seminal video game adaptation, if this isn't first, this is easily within the top 3 to 5 of most lists. Mm-hmm. And that's because it isn't afraid to be exactly what it is while, yeah, making some negotiations for the big screen.
Sure. Yes. Yeah, I would have to say, for me, it would have to be some combination of like this and that. Either the first or second Sonic the Hedgehog films. I still haven't seen the third one, but those Sonic films have done an excellent job, I think, at least. And nostalgia, probably Lara Croft Tomb Raider. Is it good?
I mean,
I don't know. I don't think it needed to be.
Okay, so we'll get to this in a future episode, but that is exactly how I feel about Annihilation. That just described to a T how I feel about that movie. Is it a good movie? Stop trying to look for Shakespeare in the park where he's not present and you'll be fine.
It's true. Two other castmates to highlight. I apologize for the pronunciation. I'm going to do my best here. We have Cary Hiroyuki Tagawa as Shang Tsung. great job. He does an excellent job here as the villain. They negotiated to let him in order to avoid all the makeup to look ancient, they negotiated to let him just kind of play it as his age. Finally, we have Telusa Soto as Kitana, who may be the character, in my opinion, who does get the most nerfed in this movie. Come on, at least give her a fan. You know, I don't want to sound like a pervert and be like, well, she's not in the blue outfit, blah, blah, blah. But at least give her a fan, guys. And Soto and Tagawa both starred in previously together in the Bond film License to Kill, where Soto was the Bond girl. So a little connecting point for them as well. Anything on those two you want to highlight?
Yeah, so I will give you credit because you were the one who shot the shot to try to pronounce his name. I wasn't going to do it because I knew I was going to butcher it. But Shang Tsung redefined the character. So for those of you that don't know, originally Shang Tsung was very old in the first one. They actually reworked the entire premise of the character based off of his role in this movie. There is a reason why, going forward, every other visual adaptation of the character is in the likeness of Cary Tagawa, because he defined Shang Tsung going forward. And they rewrote it to make Shang Tsung younger in the games because of his portrayal in this movie. This movie is not the movie that it is without him. He is the reason why this movie hits the heights that it does, because if Shang Tsung isn't the menace that he is in this movie, then everything else falls short. All of the other aspects of this are all gonna come across as campy, but like Shang Tsung actually comes across like a menace, like a villain in this movie, and just absolutely defines the character going forward.
This isn't the only change that this movie made to the video game universe. Even though he's not in it too much, the guy who plays Kano, Trevor Goddard, who plays Kano, apparently his accent was like so did not people didn't know what to make of his accent that in the games later on they retroactively change it. So he's now Australian, apparently, which I think is fascinating because he's like barely in this movie.
Yeah. He redefined Kano. And to go back to your point about Kitana, at the time, female characters in video games tended to be an afterthought. And for all of the things that generally get talked about with the big two of the time, and really like the grandparents of side-scrolling beat-em-ups with Mortal Kombat and Street Fighter, these two franchises really did a lot for female characters in the video game space and in action-oriented media like this. And so I agree that regardless of whatever costume they put it, accurate to the game, whatever, that's not really the point. The point is there was an opportunity there to make her a character with a bit more agency and a bit more gravity. And you could have very easily done that in like a simple fight. Like without being the NPC, so to speak, to Liu Kang, and still made her like more of a prominent character within the ecosystem, because she is like the character is important in the actual story of Mortal Kombat.
That role was given more so to Sonya Blade here in this film, which she kind of hovers around. She does feel maybe like the most typical 90s female side character in an action film, I would say. There are some moments where it's like, oh, she can really take care of herself. She's very strong-willed, the whole bit. And then there's other parts where it's like, stop simping for Johnny Cage, please. He's yes. not even... Look, I was not really a fan of this Johnny Cage. I'm getting Tom Cruise vibes off of this guy. And so...
So the one thing I will say is that there are two defining aspects of Johnny Cage in what like the original version. So again, for those of you that don't know, supposed to be a stand-in for Jean-Claude Van Damme. Supposed to be a riff because Van Damme was originally supposed to be in this, by Street Fighter, etc. But Lyndon Ashby really emphasizes the action hero component of it rather than like also like an accomplished martial artist and actually somebody that can handle themselves. So I'm not going to go as far as to say that the Tom Cruise vibes were by design, because I really don't think they were. I just think that's how he played the character.
Sure.
But that is a component. And I will say, I do not understand, like, yes, was he done dirty at the very beginning of Annihilation? Absolutely. But the acclaim that he was getting, like, the ravenous fanfare for a return of the character of Johnny Cage to the Mortal Kombat franchise, to me, never really made sense, because he was... I don't know, a secondary character to me more than anything else in like the early days of Mortal Kombat.
Sure. Gotcha. Joe, we are just about out of time here. So any final thoughts on MK 1995?
This is an example that you can have just schlocky fun with this sort of
absolutely
movie. Like, this is a time capsule to a period of time where action was given thought, that action also told a story, but it was the actual art of martial arts taken seriously in the context of a movie that is a love letter to the franchise that it came from. And I'll throw this in a little side note that I thought was really cool. The same actor plays both Sub-Zero and Reptile, and they did that on purpose as a nod to the fact that Scorpion, Sub-Zero, and Reptile in the original games are literally just palette swap ninjas. So there you go.
Love that. And the moment that Joe has been waiting for is now right around the corner. Next time you hear from him, it's time for Mortal Kombat Annihilation. Thanks for listening to today's episode. If you haven't yet already, please rate and review this show wherever you get your podcasts. Pass this episode along to a friend. Check out Joe and everything that's going on with him. You can find a link in the description of this episode to Thoughts from a Bearded Geek, and where you can find all of his other movie review stuff that's been going on. Been doing a deep dive into the world of Scream and Ready or Not recently. So if you're a horror fan, go check that stuff out. And you can follow this show on Instagram at Kung Fu Pizza Party and on Letterboxd, Kung Fu Pizza PRTY, where you can get a review of the movie before the episode comes out. This has been Kung Fu Pizza Party, where we've delivered high-flying action in 30 minutes or less and served up some wisdom one slice at a time.